Hello, this is the Online Resilience Podcast with me, Louisa Street, and Professor Andy Phippin. We're discussing all aspects of young people's online lives and giving practical advice on how to support the young people you work with. Music is by Rue Pascoe. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Head Start Online Resilience Podcast. Today we are joined by Maddie Street, who is this time a relation. This is my sister, who has joined us to talk about her role and her knowledge of online misogyny. So Maddie, could you start just by introducing yourself and tell us what your role is and how you got into it?
So my name's Maddie, and yes, I am sister of Louisa Street. I am a Prevent Education Officer. The kind of experience and knowledge that we're going to kind of talk about today is kind of all in my previous role, where I was Prevent Education Officer in Hackney for 2.5 years. And that's where I kind of developed an interest in online misogyny and how to kind of tackle it in schools, and started running some sessions with students. I worked in Prevent. I was a primary school teacher for about 14 years. So I come from a teaching background and have only been doing this sort of more safeguarding sort of side of things for the last 2 or 3 years.
Brilliant. Thank you. So, I mean, you mentioned online misogyny there, and it's something we've talked about on this podcast before. I think there's been increasing concern from professionals around online misogyny. From your experience of working with young people and talking about these issues, do you find that they are as concerned about this as professionals are?
Well, I think they're certainly very sort of hyper aware of it, and they're pretty knowledgeable about who's saying what. And I also found that they were very conscious of the kind of whole moral panic that has come out of it. Mm-hmm. In terms of their kind of personal concerns, certainly in talking to girls and young women in these sessions, there were some quite interesting reactions from the female students. So right at the very beginning, I started off by delivering some assemblies on online misogyny and kind of misogyny more generally, and prejudice and tolerance and that sort of thing. And we set up a safe space after the assemblies for any students to come and talk about what had been discussed during the assemblies, because obviously the format of an assembly isn't very conducive to conversation and discussion and so on. But we wanted to give them a chance to come and share their thoughts. And I'd kind of assumed it would mainly be boys who wanted to come to these sessions and kind of talk about certain influencers. But actually, a lot of girls came to the sessions and they generally were sort of sharing that they found misogyny to be pretty rife in their schools, that it was kind of everyday occurrence. And to be honest, that they came across as quite jaded, to be honest, by the whole situation. Mm-hmm. They often wanted to talk about their own experiences of misogyny and like specific things that had happened to them at school. But I would say, as kind of depressing and pessimistic as that sounds, I was actually quite heartened and surprised to hear that they were able to talk with a kind of knowledge and a vocabulary that I hadn't really anticipated. They were much more well versed in where misogyny comes from, you know, what feminism is, the history and the context of how misogyny and feminism has developed over the last sort of 100 years. And I was, as I say, I was quite pleasantly surprised to find how articulate they were about the subject. So I think that's one key thing, is just not having assumptions about what they're going to know about a subject was quite key in those first few sessions.
I must admit, I generally find conversations with young people are more knowledgeable than when I'm talking to professionals on these issues. I sort of smiled when you said, you know, you had conversation with them where they were open from the start, because Louisa and I recently did a conference where one of the questions from the audience is, how can we stop them watching Andrew Tate? Which seems to be, you know, the professional level, whereas you get young people actually unpicking it in far more detail.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I first started doing these sessions, there was a tiny percentage of students who were like, who's Andrew Tate? But within 6 months of the kind of, you know, media storm around it, there wasn't anybody in the classroom who didn't know who he was and who didn't know where this was situated sort of more broadly. So, yeah.
I mean, one of the things from that is one of the things I've sort of unpicked with young people myself in the past is whether they grasp the business model. You know, they're generally aware of the content, but you know, there's sometimes where I've gone, why do you think he might want you to give him $40 a month to tell you that your shitty life's not your fault. Why do you think that might happen? And that seems to be an unusual conversation for someone that I've come across.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so. One of the key ideas that the sort of motivators behind trying to tackle this was trying to sharpen up their critical thinking skills. Mm-hmm. And you know, critical thinking skills are something that are taught to young people right from the get-go, you know, in lots of different subjects. It's across the curriculum, but trying to really hone them in and sort of get them to unpick what's his motivation, what's behind this, you know. He's the main kind of protagonist in this story and the main influencer who young people are talking about. And so, you know, it seemed really obvious to me to say what's his motivation. It's quite evidently that he wants your money, you know, but to actually to put that to them and then to say, and you've got to do it quite carefully because you don't want to be offensive and sort of accusing them of being naive, but you know, why do you think he's targeting 13 to 25 year olds specifically? And you know, and that I felt sometimes like I was saying that and it was coming across as a little bit, you know, obviously he's doing this, you know, you should have been sharper and you should have picked up on this. But yeah, so asking them to try and be a bit more critical about why that content is how it is, where it's situated, why it's behind a paywall, those sort of things, as a starting point for questioning why he's so appealing, I suppose.
I mean, something I know I've talked about on this podcast before is that sort of process of questioning people's motivations. And it's something that I used to do when I talk to young people about drugs. And I would say, what do you think your drug dealer, what do you think a drug dealer's motivation is when they're telling you about drugs? What are your parents' motivations? What do you think my motivation is? And unpicking that with all of the potential stakeholders, I think is really interesting because you can start to see what their perception of the different adults in their lives are and then maybe challenge that a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like if they're saying, oh, well, I think my parents are just trying to stop me having fun. Then it's like, oh, okay. Do you think there might be another reason that they're concerned about this?
I know you won't mention it, Louisa, but you did write an extremely good blog post about this a while ago, which you could probably stick in the show notes, actually, because it's still as relevant today as that. It always, but I think in that, you know, you were sort of saying, you know, The critical thinking aspect is far more useful than targeting a specific individual. And I know I've had conversations with professionals saying, well, the one that amuses me the most is, but what about OnlyFans? And it's like, yeah, okay, so that's another commercial thing. So if they're under 18, they shouldn't be thinking about that as a career choice. If they're over 18, explain to them. But again, it's kind of like, why are people doing this? How do people make money from it? Things and trying to take a step back from the more volatile subject matter itself is certainly always the view I take.
And it's he's quite clever in that sense, Andrew Tate, because he kind of, it's what we talk, when we're talking about extremism, one of the things we talk about is this like rule of 10. So extreme radicalizers will use this rule to say 9 things that are very true, very relatable, very acceptable, and there's really good evidence for them. And then they'll just say 1 thing that's utter nonsense. But because the 9 things that have come before have felt real, you know, it's more difficult to unpick that one thing that's not true. So one of the things that I think appeals to young men about Andrew Tate is that it's not all about misogyny. A lot of it's about making money, business, being a good citizen, being healthy, you know, looking after your mum and all these kind of things that we actually do value as a society. And then he just slips in the one little thing there about how your girlfriend is property, and it doesn't scream. It's not a red flag, because everything that's come before it has really resonated and has felt really believable.
I notice he seems to be jumping on the trad family bandwagon as well at the moment as well. It's a lot about being home and women having children and things, which does tie in with some of the neocon stuff that's flying around as well.
Might be
some funding in it.
Can I just clarify, is neocon like neoconservative, so sort of new?
There's a whole bunch of conservative movements at the more right wing end of the Conservative Party and similar, which are saying similar political messaging to some of the more right wing views in the US as well. And there's a lot of stuff coming out about how women need to stay home and have more babies and stuff now because we're having a population crisis, not because it's a controlling, you know, they try and justify it from that point of view rather than saying women shouldn't have careers or women shouldn't have lives of their own. So.
And I think that kind of, and this is a bit of a an additional question, really. I think, you know, a lot of women work in the child workforce and feel very personally connected to some of these issues. Have you found a way of kind of putting some of that to one side when you're talking to young people about this, or do you bring your values with you, and how do you do
really
it?
Difficult. Yeah, it's really difficult, because I think, you know, particularly as a woman who's worked in education for a long time and has studied gender and is quite passionate about equality, I want to be able to do this work and I want to be able to help and, you know, and support young people who are maybe being drawn into this kind of maybe negative space. And, you know, there was I was always working with another teacher whilst we were doing these sessions. And as it happened, they were always female. Both of us would try, we discuss it beforehand, try and keep a neutral persona and not react to the things that were being said, because some of the students would say things that were shocking, that were offensive, that were really uncomfortable to hear. And I could, although we were both trying really hard to keep these kind of very neutral personas, I could see the other teacher getting frustrated by the things and wanting to argue back. And I think one of the things we have to do as professionals is think about who is best placed to be having these conversations. And as I say, I hate it that it's not always me. But when I was looking at these young men who come from vastly different ethnic, socioeconomic, generational, gendered backgrounds from me, it's about representation and, you know, them seeing themselves in the person that's talking to them. And it's not always going to be the person who wants to do the work. And I think sometimes you have to look at utilising your allies within schools. And, you know, that is difficult in education settings, where a lot of the time it is predominantly a female workforce. So I think it's about making sure that the good male role models that schools have are all singing from the same hymn sheet, you know, and really picking up on anything that could be considered to be misogynistic language, that sort of thing. And schools have often asked me, well, you know, we don't have very many male role models within this setting, how can we do this? And there are organisations that can come in, you know, and do this work for you. But unfortunately, they'll often be behind a paywall, or they'll be running out of government funding rapidly. You know, we've seen a lot, unfortunately, of our project providers have you know, had to fold or do something different because they don't have any funding anymore. But and you know, I think that then we need to look at it as a more broader systemic kind of issue. It's not something that we can just have one male PE teacher or you know, one male drama group come in and do the sessions. We need to be having these conversations about stereotypes and misogyny right from the early years all the way through, thinking about diverse role models, letting them talk about their experiences and their lives, and going back to those critical thinking skills, making sure that that's something that's like runs through it all the way. The people who want to do the work aren't necessarily always the best place to have the biggest impact, you know. It's just unfortunately the way that works out.
I think it's interesting though, because perhaps those people who are in that position where they're feeling really passionate about the subject and they want to take a different approach to it, perhaps their role is more inspiring their colleagues than doing all of the lessons themselves. And yeah, I think it's so important if you're going to do something that is a bit unusual, whether that's, you know, the way that you're dealing with online misogyny, or the way that you're teaching relationships and sex education, or the way that you're talking about gaming, making sure that all of the other teachers in the school or all of the other youth workers in the organization, or, you know, wherever you are all on the same page is so important, because it's so easy for you to put hours of work into something and then the kids go into the next lesson and say, oh, Mrs. So-and-so said this, that and the other, and for that teacher to be like, oh no, I'm not sure that's right actually.
No, it's one thing I was going to say actually, because you said you did quite a lot of assemblies, is do you feel like the assemblies were a good vehicle for this stuff, or did you, I'm reflecting on my own experience, often leave frustrated thinking I could have spent 3 hours with those young people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things that's so frustrating, and I'm sure you've had this experience as well, is that school timetables are just so busy that they're well, we do 25 minutes. And it's like, that is not enough time for me to do my introduction. I haven't even had my illustrious career in that time. I'm only joking, but, you know, it does really hard to get a good stint with these young people. So the most recent student sessions that I'd done were with the year seven class, and I'd managed to get a 6 week block with these students, which was amazing, to do an hour a week with them for 6 weeks. Cause it, you know,
it is really good.
We could build on what was said last lesson, and I could go away, reflect, change the lesson plan, you know, be a bit reflective and responsive to what they'd said. And I felt like those sessions were, we dug down so much deeper into the subject matter. And, you know, actually, because I think a lot of the time they were quite giddy in some of these sessions.
Yes. Just
they were allowed to talk about it, you know. And in a lot of the schools that I've been working with, the schools have had to find a quick fix for this, which is, you know, a bit like what's going on in the Middle East. It's easier if we just say you're not going to talk about it at all, because we can't, and that's no, you know, criticism or reflection on the schools, but they can't cope with what the output of that, of allowing those conversations, you know, they'd have to come off timetable for a week and just work through, you know, the things that the students are experiencing. And that's, I think, you know, in an ideal world, that's what you do, isn't it? But
yeah,
we did actually get to hear a bit more once they'd calmed down and they'd realized, you know, that actually you're allowed to talk about this here, it's a safe space. And they also, I think, found it all quite exciting to be able to say what they perceived to be insulting things or rude things, or, you know, use language that they wouldn't normally be allowed to use. So once that novelty had worn off, we actually had some really good conversations.
Yes.
And that's why time is so important, but always difficult to.
No, in the old days where I used to do porn sessions, you'd have 10, 15 minutes with a group of young men where they'd be asking you, have you seen this one, sir? And have you seen this one, sir? And after 15 minutes, they started to ask really serious questions about body image and performance anxiety and stuff. But if you didn't have that 15 minutes, and most importantly, you didn't have that 15 minutes where there was someone else trying to shut them down the whole time. Then you know, it's so important to have a long period of time with them, I think. Yeah, definitely.
So in those sessions, did you have any problems? And if so, how did you deal with them? Like, and when I say problems, I'm kind of thinking of like people really expressing those misogynistic views.
I mean, they were, in the first few sessions, they were coming in quite defensively of people like Andrew Tate and sort of saying, oh, you know, what he's saying is being taken out of context and you don't get it, he's a role model for us, and the kind of famous, oh, well, what colour's your Bugatti, miss, and all this. Red, what colour's yours? I didn't take an Uber bike here. And, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff was hard to hear, and it seemed so archaic, and it just seemed, for me at my age, that they were saying things that boys were saying 25 years ago.
That we thought was behind us, yeah.
Yeah, quite depressing. But then on the other hand, there were, you know, I didn't come out feeling completely pessimistic, as I say, from these sessions, because there were quite a few, you know, quite sharp students who were making observations about the fact that this is getting out of hand because you as adults are letting it get out of hand. This is moral panic. You know, they could see that as soon as they said Andrew Tate, all the adults just freaked out and didn't know what to say. And a lot of them would say, you know, we say the things he says and we do the hand gestures that he does, and we kind of use the quotes because it gets a reaction, because it's, we're being provocative and, you know, shocking. And, you know, that's quite an appealing thing to do, and for adults as well as young. And some of them were quite astute and would sort of say, well, he's just playing a character. You know, he's not a real role model. He's just like a caricature, and that, you know, it's not a new phenomena. He's just being controversial. He's just the most recent controversial figure. And then there was one who really stands out. I'm sure I've told you this one already, Louisa, but one student who said, he's just like, you know, this is just like the moral panic of the rappers in the 90s, where everybody said, oh, if young people listen to rap music, they'll all turn into violent gangsters. And obviously there were some ramifications of that scene at the time, but it kind of changed the way I think about it, in that Andrew Tate he's not revolutionary. He's not saying anything super exciting. He's just a symptom of a really old existing.
Just watch a Bernard Manning routine from the 70s. At the time, it was more acceptable. So, yeah.
And one of the things that a lot of the writing and research and stuff that I've read about it has said, that what we've got to remember about this, him being a symptom of this phenomena, is that for a lot of young men, they do feel really disenfranchised. They feel left behind. They feel like feminism has disadvantaged them. And suddenly there's this role model who's saying, it's okay, I'm here, I understand you, your life is hard. And, you know, he's just responding to, you know, there's a market for it, and he's absolutely got himself in the right place.
I know Johnny Hunt and Emily Setti have written a couple of conversation pieces, and one of them is specifically, rather than worrying about Andrew Tate, think about why that message might appeal to young men and the disenfranchisement that's happened and things, and which is, I guess, a more complicated message than, well, why can't we just switch off the Andrew Tate content, which, you know, comes back to the things that Louisa and I deal with a great deal. Surely the social media companies could stop this if they wanted to. Yeah.
Well,
I noticed in the, sorry, Louisa, in the Scottish hate speech laws that have just come out, they're specifically excluded misogyny, because they're going to look at it separately, and there's other people that say, well, legally speaking, it's incredibly difficult to define, so it would be very difficult to actually, I mean, the new hate speech law in Scotland is interesting enough anyway, but
I haven't gone anywhere near that yet.
it's worth exploring, because it's basically, we think, if you think it's bad, the police have got to decide if it's bad.
Right.
Now, I always thought the police's role was to enforce the legislation put down by the legislature, rather than interpreting it how they see fit, because that strikes me as poor legislation. But that might just be my you know, liberal views on these sorts of things.
I mean, I think there is, you know, we've talked a lot about curating your feed on social media, and funnily enough, I was talking to my brother about this, and he was saying that he gets a lot of misogynistic content that he doesn't want
to see.
Can
you guys adopt me, so I can be part of the family as well?
Honestly, our Christmas lunch conversations are really cheerful. I really like half of them fun.
But, you know, I think if you're a man of a certain age and you're into certain things like gaming or sports, then you are going to be pushed some of this content. And one of the things that my brother said was that he feels that he sort of watches it compulsively, like he doesn't want to see it, but it's like he can't look away. But then he just gets more and more of it, even if he says, I don't want to see it. And I think that's really difficult. And, you know, I don't want my social media feed, you know, full of Andrew Tate, but I'm really curious about the things that he's saying. So just kind of thinking about, as a professional, where would you recommend that someone should go to find information without it potentially making their newsfeed all misogyny content?
Yeah, it's quite difficult. I mean, there's lots of really good organizations putting out kind of it's not neutral, but trying to put out measured advice, and some of the, so Votes for Schools, Facing History and Ourselves, ADL, they've all published, Institute for Family Studies, lots of different, I can link all of these over to you so you can share them, but lots of them have published fact sheets, you know, ideas on how to have these conversations with young people, as well as sort of trying to take a balanced view. Because one of the other things that I've heard colleagues say is you've got to be a bit careful talking about him, that you're not slandering him, because at the point that this all blew up, he hadn't been charged with anything. And then there was concern that if we start saying all this stuff about him and it never comes to anything, that there could be some sort of kickback and kind of, you know, legal ramifications on that sort of thing. So it had to be quite careful to just state the facts. And that's what these organizations do, and they're really good, and, you know, they want young people to get a balanced view on these things. So I think there's definitely some great pieces out there for professionals and for students, which I will share so that you've got, your listeners can have a look at those if they want to.
Brilliant. Yeah, that'd be really helpful. Thank you. And I'll put all of that in the show notes. And more sort of broadly, is there any advice that you would give to someone who wanted to discuss issues like these, whether in a classroom or in a one-to-one setting?
Yeah, so I think first and foremost, we have to approach this with empathy. So as I said, you know, a lot of the young men that I spoke to who were expressing quite misogynistic views came from quite challenging backgrounds, were living in quite severe poverty, had really difficult early childhood experiences, and were lacking aspirations and lacking optimism. So I think being quite sympathetic, trying to go into this being sympathetic is quite crucial, and thinking about why have they gone down this path, why have they started kind of engaging with this quite extreme stuff. In terms of kind of practical advice, the advice that I give to colleagues and to teachers when they ask comes from a blog that was published by, it was by Votes for Schools. And again, I'll share that. But it essentially covers three main points. So you guys will know this. So first and foremost, if you think you know a lot about a subject, be prepared to not be the expert in the room when you start having those conversations with people. But try and encourage them to be open and let them have their say. Be ready to hear things that shock you, but to think that it's better to that they're able to say those in the safe space that is your classroom, rather than saying them online or, you know, looking online for answers or for more information that might lead them down a path. And our job really as professionals is to lead them to the right conclusion rather than telling them what to believe. The other thing is around community. So in terms of for those people who are feeling lost or disenfranchised, these groups do provide a sense of community. And as I said before, it gives them somebody who's saying, yes, we hear you, we see you, we understand your life is difficult. They will tend to offer quite simple answers to complicated mm-hmm. questions, but that's sometimes what people need to hear if they're feeling mm-hmm. lost, you know, mm-hmm. and that they're dealing with what they feel are real problems. So we do need to understand that, you know, they are getting something out of these communities. We need to sort of understand that if we ask them to leave that community, what are we mm-hmm. inviting them into? Mm-hmm. We can't just leave them floundering. We have to offer them an alternative and sort of understanding that hate and anger aren't long-term plans to cope with how they feel and to get them to happier places.
That's so interesting, because I was reading something recently about how you should teach young people about drugs to prevent them from starting to use drugs, and the conclusion was provide lots of other things for them to get involved in, lots of other meaningful activities that they can do, and then like the small bit of it is, and then also tell them about the risks about drugs. It's not, you know, we'd love to think that we could just say, don't do this, it's really dangerous, or don't follow these influencers because we don't like what they're saying, and that would be the end of it. But yeah, so much of it is, what are they filling up their time with if it's not that thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then the last point really is about trying really hard to kind of not be judgmental and thinking about that, you know, they may feel quite outcast already and frustrated, and that's why it led them towards anger and hate. And so judging them, even if you're just doing it internally, isn't very helpful. So trying to, you know, having that open dialogue, letting them know that they can come and talk to you about these things, because, you know, as you'll know, if young people feel judged or threatened, they're going to shut down. Yeah. Or it's going to become a shouting match, or they're just going to put you on their do not speak to list, which then leaves them even more adrift, really, you know. So I think trying really hard to, and, you know, it's not, as I will often say to colleagues, it's not our job to fix them and to make sure that they come out of this cured, but just to offer them an alternative narrative, but offer them a safe space and the support to explore these views, guide them and lead them towards more positive outcomes. But yeah, it's not something, as you'll know from working with young people with drugs, pushing them in that direction is going to be fruitful.
I think it ties in a lot with what we do with the Head Start resilience, digital resilience stuff as well, in trying to get professionals to grasp that they don't need to save these young people, they need to support these young people. And yeah, the number of times you have to go, well, if you tried listening to them about what they feel that way? It's normally senior leaders that struggle with that. I don't know why that would be. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can speak on that a little bit, because, you know, I before I came into what I'm doing now, I was an assistant head teacher at my previous school. And I think you do lose touch with what it's like to be on the shop floor, and you become very fixated on statistics and figures and, you know, big policy as opposed to real people. And that's why I left, because I didn't like that.
I did say on another podcast a while ago, but the head teacher at a secondary school I was working in sat in on a discussion group a few years ago now, and she said at the end of it, she's learned so much. I'm like, you spend 8 hours a day in these buildings with these young people. She went, yeah, but never get a chance to listen to them. So
such a shame, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean we have reflected recently on whether recent behavioral strategies and things are actually sending things backwards in terms of putting up barriers between those adults that can support young people and young people's need. We certainly experienced some of it in some of the places we're working.
The last question I was going to ask you, and I feel like you've kind of answered it, but I just maybe reflect on what you were saying, is I was going to say, is there anything that people need to know? Is there any really vital knowledge if people are going to go into a discussion like this? But I think, like you said, it doesn't really matter how much you know. There's always going to be someone in the room who has a different perspective or knows more about it or has seen something you haven't seen. But is there anything that you think, like, do people need to know what a CHAD is or what a BETA is?
I don't think so, no. And I think, you know, a lot of the advice is, as soon as you give them that vocabulary, then it will be used. And so I'm not sort of saying, oh, don't tell them about it and then they'll be protected from it. But as soon as you sort of start laying down loads and loads of vocab and stuff, it's going to be used for a period. It's going to be novel and it's going to be funny and stuff. The thing I would relate it to is when I'm doing my general prevent training and we talk about online platforms and, you know, where you might see extremist material and, you know, how the more sophisticated young people become as internet users, the more obscure the sites are to the adult teaching population. You don't need to know how all of these sites work intricately. You don't need to be a user of them to offer support. You just need to know how to facilitate a conversation where a young person can open up to you if they have a problem or if they're worried about something or if they've seen something that's upsetting, and that they know that by talking to you, they're not going to end up in trouble or they're not going to end up, you know, having to follow some sort of strict set of rules. But yeah, I don't think you need to be an expert on the whole kind of counterculture of the manosphere to listen and to offer support, non-judgmental support. And then, you know, it might be that you have to make some sort of referral, whether it's through your school safeguarding policies or to multi-agency safeguarding hubs or whatever, because sometimes there will need to be some sort of support or intervention. But I think, yeah, the first port of call should just be calm listening, not reacting, and feeding into the kind of what they're expecting to see from the adult that they talk to.
We've been saying for a while that the subheading of this podcast should be don't panic. That really
don't bracket moral panic.
Excellent. Well, it's been really interesting talking to you, certainly from my perspective. Do either of you have any final thoughts before we kind of wrap up?
I just think that the point about not feeling like you have to be the most knowledgeable person in the room is so important in all of these different areas, because, you know, you sit there and go, oh, what's that? I didn't know about that. It's quite refreshing for them to hear that from an adult as well.
Yeah. And for them to get to then feel like they are the most knowledgeable person in the room.
Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Maddie. It's been lovely talking to you, and we will be back with another podcast soon. That's it for another episode of the Online Resilience Podcast. If you liked it, please tell someone you know who might also enjoy it. You can share on Facebook, Twitter, or even just pop a link in an email.